I think that a dog must feel like this sometimes. This complete, just by laying its head down and smelling in the fabric a beloved. I could happily never leave this room, though my lover appears to tell me that distortion is everything. Hearing it from a song and then coming to the doorway to bring home the point. And surely true that our love is a distortion, a wrinkle in fabric that no amount of his inserting himself into me can smooth. The last time at a restaurant, he wore a dress, and I had almost never seen anything so lovely. A dark dress, and his body a naked and muscled gift beneath, so that when I saw a photo of Donatello's David some months later, I could not stop staring, they were so alike. His walk the way David's might be, all saucy schoolgirl charm. And later this same night at home, he danced for me, hips making a small hula motion, hands in his hair, his face slit-eyed and crafty at his power. When he smoothed his fine torso, I thought, corny, then broke at how his hands moved like lovers over his belly, his ribcage. We are sweet and rotting, the hands seemed to say, grainy fruit plopped in yellow grass. Eat. How was it in the days before he disrupted my heart? What did I look at in the days before his face? Because I am watching him always now like a dog from my sprawl in the sunlight, going still when he strokes my hair flat, or more lovely still, plunges through the fur and back in time to my skull. When a friend tells me how she carries in her mind's eye a miniaturized picture of her girlfriend, yes, she says, so that when I think her up, she's standing in a certain way, with a certain expression, a smirk almost, and wearing a black hat. I think that she's remarkably self-possessed. I don't tell her that he moves across my thoughts in pieces, random as these moments of rhythmic, drowsy stroking, and that I peer for him exactly as my dog, left outside, peers through the sliding glass door, her expression strained and foolish. And lovesick. I'm reminded of a line from a kung fu movie appearing in tiny white letters across the bottom of the screen when a character asks, "Don't you scare of death?" And I think, I do, I do. I think how my lover feels like a future, and I scare of death plenty, the way my own mother scares, and so has colored her hair for the last 10 years a hateful shade of yellow, like doll hair, like trying to prove she's still holding all the cards. And he, knowing that we don't have time to fritter, spends much of his time spelunking, finding me out. When we're done, both of us have the kinds of marks children leave on each other, Indian burns and titty twists, and though we've entered each other in every possible place, still there is never any way to get close or fierce enough. In bed each night, I peruse his body for signs. Pimples and scars and tiny brown scraps of earwax, as though these might explain something. Yet daily we become less intelligible, our happiness a freakish happenstance, so utterly far-fetched that I find myself waiting for anything, anyone, to take him away and then turn to me and say plainly, "All gone." Instead I hoard things, brood senselessly over tender body parts. His head, for instance, which could so easily be crushed, yet each day, brazen, it enters the world, chances crowds and car trips as though it were not a planet but an ordinary human bone cap. I want to make him wear a helmet. Maudlin, I know, to dwell, but if he'd been my infant, I'd have known bottom wiping and the soft pebbles of his testes in his first human sounds, wanting to speak him before he himself could speak. Because how could I be so lucky? How could anyone? He has massaged my temples, holding my head in his lap. Above me, his face is upside down, and sometimes, massaging, he simply rests his mouth against mine while his fingers make slow circles near my ears. Sweetness, sweetness. A snail would find him by extending sweet slime knobs, but I am less scientific. My hands love him too much to be cautious, and so creep like perverts across the heat and sleep smell of our bed, sink deep to the spongy, fragrant skull. A forest, really. And if you were a flea, you'd see. Each hair a tree to step around. When I began to love him, it came upon me like something dreadful or hideous. I wasn't glad at all. Why should I be, I thought then, knowing how soon his name would have the force of a bludgeon. A simple name of a few letters and a short sound, intricately stitched into my skin. I was undone by it. You could have hissed this word at me through the walls of a womb, and I would have turned, stirred in the saline, to hear the sound that meant him. I knew that whatever happened, the particular clump of letters, his name, would attach to other things. His name, Grant, both a noun for him and a verb meaning to bestow. It happens occasionally in the world that someone says, take for granted, says, I'll grant you that, and how then I want to applaud at how my day has just been beautified. Is this how a dog hears itself spoken? By the sound of a loved one's voice, nothing more. As a kid, the assignment of naming pets overwhelmed me. I'd chew over the possibilities for days until finally someone else in the family would intervene, put me out of my misery long enough to say, we're just going to call her Lulu, okay? Just Lulu. But Lulu meant things, and meant not calling the dog other things. Queenie, for example, or Angie. And if you called her Angie, it meant you could croon the Rolling Stones song into the dog's quiet face. Angie, you could sing, you're beautiful, you can't say we never tried. Even then, it was the finding words for things that messed things up. Better to be free-floating and witless, like the child I read about in the newspaper who was not destined to live in this world. The girl's name was Courtney Ann, but her mama instead called her bitch all the time, between the time she was hitting the girl. And when the daughter blessedly died of a brain hemorrhage, the neighbors told how Courtney, when the mama said, bitch, would look up to hear her name. I could picture the 2-year-old baby blinking foolishly in the direction of her mama's hatred. Afterward, the mama took Courtney Ann's body to a graveyard. By then, the voices in the mother's head jabbering and yakety and loud, you can bet, and she left Courtney Ann's body on a hill. Left it there, and walked off, listening. Or those twins, remember? It was the 1960s, and they had their own language not even the mom or dad could understand. This went on until they turned 7, at which time they surrendered and got to appear on TV. After all those years, the dad theorized into the mic, they'd had a breakthrough. One of the black-eyed twins said, hello. Hello, and hello, and hello. She said it in a tiny voice, looking ancient and unconvinced. Viewers at home would just have to believe her heart was in it. After this, the twins waved helplessly. They were lovely. They looked like little Anne Franks. And then the other twin seemed to figure something out suddenly. She touched her tiny pillbox hat in wonderment and began to weep. Maybe she was beginning to figure out how even being able to say things in the world wasn't enough, how sounds were like stick figure drawings for what a person might really mean. Maybe she'd figured out that now everyone could see her and would expect things, such as answers to questions. By the time the twins turned 11, they'd forgotten every speck of their secret language. Like the mom said shrewdly, there was no more necessity. My lover and I went bowling once, and I remember how from behind he was narrow-shouldered and intent, gauging his shot, and then the few steps forward and the pretty way one leg slid behind when he let go of the ball. Then he turned and walked back to me, watching me all the way, and I felt like $1,000,000. I was thinking a silly thing. I was thinking, darling, I am a dog. I have loved you always.
That was Static by Nicole Stansbury, read by the author. Production facilities by Story Tactics. Copyright 2008 Nicole Stansbury.